all through a few different phases in the last week. And I guess I sort of have to start with an apology for being a Midwesterner talking about the Cascades, but there are a lot of Midwesterners here that are new to the neighborhood, so I'd like to share a little bit of what I've learned over the last 3.5 years, but mostly over the last 3 days, about the Cascades, about the history of the Lake Chelan area, a little bit about mining, and a little bit about our valley, the Willow Creek Valley. I'd like to start with a short story, legend, about the origin of the Cascades. And this was told by a man named Clarence Pickernell, who was a Quinault, Chehalis, and Cowlitz Indian. All of those peoples are from the far west coast, but they gazed upon the mountains, and this is their legend of how the Cascade Range came to be. One time when the world was very young, the land east of where the Cascades Mountains now stand became very dry. This was in the early days before rains came to the earth. In the beginning of the world, moisture came up through the ground, but for some reason it stopped coming. Plants and trees withered and died. There were no roots and no berries for food. The water in the streams became so low that salmon could no longer live there. The ancient people were hungry. At last they sent a group of their people westward to ask ocean for water. "Our land is drying up," they told him. "Send us water, lest we starve and die." "I will send you my sons and daughters," Ocean promised the people, "and they will help you." Ocean's sons and daughters were clouds and rain. They went home with the messengers from the dry countries, and soon there was plenty of moisture. Plants and trees, became green and grew again. Streams flowed with water, and many fish lived in them again. Roots and berries grew everywhere, and there was plenty to eat. But the people were not satisfied with plenty. They wanted more. They wanted to be sure they would always have water. So they dug great pits and asked clouds and rain to fill them. Clouds and rain stayed away from their father Ocean so long that he became lonely, and after many moons, he sent his messengers to ask that his sons and daughters be allowed to come home. "Let my children return home. You have enough water for the present, and I will see that you have enough in the future." But the people were selfish and refused to let clouds and rain go. The messengers had to return to Ocean empty-handed. Then the Ocean told his troubles to the Great Spirit. "Punish the people for their evil ways. Punish them for always wanting more and more." The Great Spirit heard his prayer. He leaned down from the sky and scooped up a great amount of earth and made the Cascade Mountains as a wall between Ocean and the dry country. The long, deep hole left where the earth had been, and Ocean soon filled with water. Today, people call it Puget Sound. The people east of the mountains are still punished for their selfishness and greed. Ocean sends so little moisture over the rain that they do not have all the plants that grow along the coast. But they still have the pits their grandfathers dug. They are Lake Chelan and the lake south of it. Ocean still grieves for his sons and daughters who did not come home. All day and all night along the beach he calls to them and sings his mournful song. Atala, atala, come home, come home. Are you going to be able to see if I point to that map over there? Or would it be better for me to move it?
Move it.
All right.
This is elementary geography of the Pacific Northwest.
Set it on the chair.
Okay. You want some help?
Okay, I can do that. Thank you.
Yes, we can't see it though. Well, this is just outline stuff, but to kind of bring in the idea that the Cascade Range extends throughout mostly Washington and Oregon, but it does meet with the Sierras in California and with the Coast Range of Canada, British Columbia. I don't know this personally, but I've read that the Cascades in the south in Oregon are very different in character from our northern Cascades. it's an interesting range in that there's a lot of volcanic activity superimposed upon mountains that have been uplifted and twisted and glaciated. The northern Cascades are much more rugged in character. Lots of glacier activity has shaped those mountains, whereas Oregon has many more volcanoes that I didn't put in there. Some of you probably came in from the east, from Minnesota, so you probably hit Wenatchee at some point, went up to Chelan, and here's our lake, our fjord like Lake Chelan, in the heart of the North Cascades. There's not a whole lot of ways to get to the west coast. You have to go via Snoqualmie and Blewett Passes or Stevens Pass. That's always intrigued me. As a Midwesterner, you could just go wherever you wanted to over the plains, but here you have to sneak through the mountain passes. I think that's enough of that. I want to talk a little bit about geology, about formation. I have never had a geology course in my life, so you won't hear me say Pleistocene or Eocene because I don't know what that means. What I do know is that long, long, long ago, there was a sea covering this area. And as all seas have sediments that pack down, sedimentary rocks were formed. And even at the tops of some of these mountains, geologists have found sedimentary rocks and some fossils of prehistoric sea critters that fell to the bottom when they died. There was a period of uplift, of twisting and folding of the land, changes in rock, metamorphosizing of sedimentary rock, and through eons and eons, a mountain range was born. It was a high plain that was lifted up, and water, as it was being lifted, water was just as busily eroding, so you had sharp features, V-shaped valleys, thanks to water erosion. Ice ages happened, probably starting several million years ago. The latest one was about 10,000 years ago. But successive waves of ice sheets came through the continents, down, well, through Minnesota at least four times, and through here several times. But also here is the added scraping away of the Alpine glaciers right through this valley. Our valley has been carved into a beautiful U shape because of the scraping and scouring of the glaciers. Lake Chelan is one of the largest gorges dug out by any glacier. I think, Jeff, why don't you turn on the slide projector, and I think I can talk better if I have something to look at than you. Well, these are kind of out of order, but this is coming up Lake Chelan, which everybody in this room has done, and on the left is Domke Mountain, which we go around, and behind that is Lucerne where we get off. This is looking up towards Stehekin. Okay. And from Lucerne, above Lucerne, looking up lake towards Stehekin, that little peninsula on the right is called Moore's Point, and I'll be talking more about Mr. Moore and his goings-on later. Okay, glaciers, here's a... I think this is the valley right behind Martin Ridge, is that right? What's that called? No? Isn't that looking toward Hilgard Pass, David?
Yeah.
So what's that valley called?
I don't think it has.
Oh, well, just over the ridge behind the village. But you can get the idea of the beautiful U-shape carved out by the valley. This was new to me. Coming from the Midwest, I think of valleys being V-shaped along the Mississippi riverbeds. Deep carving by water erosion makes a very steep, narrow bottom valley. Okay, go ahead. This is the glacier in the neighborhood that's closest, right here. And that's the Mary Green Glacier on Bonanza Peak, and it's probably just a teeny patch left of what once filled this valley thousands and thousands of years ago. It came down here, carved out Holden Lake, and was met then by a larger valley which was filling all of Railroad Creek that carved out Heart Lake. Some of you made many hikes up there. One of our volcanoes of the Cascade Range is behind us, about, I don't know, 30 miles away, that's Glacier Peak.
Is that it on there?
Pardon?
Is that it that you're pointing at?
This is Glacier Peak, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. But again, you can see the bowl shape or the U shape of the valley. Okay. This is looking down the valley back toward Holden. There's the tailings. Again, just getting the idea of the U shape. This probably was a moraine. I'm only guessing. I'm not a geologist. Left when the glacier was backing up and dumped some of its load of grit and gravel. Glaciers start out as snowfields. Apparently there was enough change in weather that more snow was falling and staying on snowfields than was melting in the summer. Over thousands of years, snow accumulated in large snowfields, and thanks to pressure, snow changes into ice. And just like when you squash down a piece of silly putty, it starts to flow, becomes very plastic. It's nice that in mountains it can flow downhill. That sounds like water flows downhill. But even the continental glaciers that covered Minnesota, there wasn't any downhill. It was just that pressure of accumulated ice and snow that was spreading its fingers, lobes, southward. So one lobe was filling this valley clear up to almost up to the brim. That was all ice at one point. Okay. This is a view of a glacier on Glacier Peak, one of the volcanoes. Interesting combination of a volcano, once hot and roaring, now covered with mini glaciers. You can see how as it comes over a bump here, the ice starts to crack and form crevasses. Okay. There's David standing. Where is that?
Bonanza.
No, that's the Middle Cascade Glacier.
Oh, that's northwest of here. But you can see at the bottom it becomes a tumble, jumble maze of ice, an ice ball. Then that represents who knows how many hundreds of years of ice accumulation there. Okay? And that is on Bonanza. That's on the Mary Green Glacier, which we can see right from the tailings, looking into a crevasse that I swear went all the way to China. Okay. All right, why don't you flick that off and we'll have some lights again. Kurt, do the lights turn on somewhere where I can get them? I don't know who turned them. Oh, thank you. Land is continued to be shaped. I think one of the most exciting things for me has been learning about glaciers. Growing up, we talked about glaciers all the time in the Midwest because Minnesota is so... the 10,000 lakes are thanks to the glaciers. There are a lot of evidences of kettles and lakes and other glacial formations that tell us of the Ice Age, but that was 10,000 years ago, and nobody in my family can remember that. That was kind of, you know, a long time ago. But here, within 4 hours, I can be in the Ice Age if I walk to the head of this valley, either on the Mary Green or up at Lyman Lake at the head of Railroad Creek Valley, the beginning of our watershed. There is still a glacier that is, again, just a tiny patch of what once filled this valley. But I'm in the Ice Age. Ice is retreating. All that's there is rock. If I come down a little farther, I see the beginnings of some plant life. And then by the time I get home, well, I'm in a total forest. So that, to me, is kind of history happening right there. I have looked, not extensively, but I have looked for information on Native peoples that were here before the white man came, and I have found not a great wealth of information. What I do gather is that people probably weren't living here at this elevation permanently. The rivers were too abundant, good hunting and good fishing and gathering places, but there probably were hunting trips up into this area in the fall, or berry gathering trips. I think people were going through here, but not living here permanently.
Libby, when is that that you're talking about? When is that that you're talking about?
Any time before the 1850s. Please, if anybody has questions, I certainly don't want this to be me just feeling for
it. What's the name of the tribe?
what I have read is that the people in the area were of a large people called the Okanagan. And these names you will hear again because it's a place name of an area east of here. Okanagan people, and then two subgroups, the Chelan and the Eniat Indians. Chelan, this area, and the Eniat a little bit to the south and west of us.
Do you know the translation of the names?
No, I don't. Anybody know that?
Chelan means very deep waters.
Very deep waters? Okay. I know that they had a real respect and fear of the lake. They didn't canoe around on this lake a lot. They knew that it was dangerous waters. They didn't venture forth on it real often. As far as the white man coming into the area, I read about a little voyage that two British ships were making up the west coast, commanded by Captain Vancouver in the 1790s. And they were looking for a passageway and started coming in the straits and in toward Puget Sound. And Land Ho was called, and they saw the Cascades. And that's the first recorded sighting by white people of the Cascade Mountains. And the third lieutenant was Lieutenant Baker. And he shouted up to his captain and recorded that he had seen, what did he say? He described a high, conspicuous, craggy mountain, which later bore his name, Mount Baker, and to the south, a long ridge of rugged and snowy mountains. They also picked out Mount Rainier, which isn't hard, it looms so high from the coast, but they did not see Glacier Peak, the volcano that I pointed out. Cloud cover, maybe they just didn't pick it out, but it is visible from Seattle on certain days. But Glacier Peak kind of was a mystery mountain for a long, long time. In fact, till about the turn of the century, people hardly were aware of its presence, and if they knew it, they didn't know how to get here. It was for their Glacier Peak. It was such difficult terrain to negotiate. Then, 1805 brought Lewis and Clark trekking through the Great Northwest, and there, back on my map, they made their way through the mountains along the Columbia, the gorge there, and the chutes. That route became the route for settlers and fur traders and miners, and everybody poured in through that route, but nobody ever stayed or explored in the mountains. It was just something to get through and to get to the west coast, where there were beautiful valleys to farm and timber to be cut. So the Cascades remained pretty much unknown. But the hardy fur traders that the northern lakes of Minnesota made their way out here. Well, probably not the same people, but Hudson Bay and Northwest Company trappers kept their thirst for the beaver pelt up, and fur traders did come into the area. And that would have been early 1800s, I would imagine. The name Cascade Mountains comes, I think, from the route that Lewis and Clark took through the mountains that I mentioned. There were many, many, many waterfalls in that area of the Columbia, and that was a dangerous crossing for them, a dangerous portage through, and that area became known as the Cascades of the Columbia River. Well, then the whole mountain range took on that name. Map number two. I'm going to talk a little bit about Lake Chelan. Lake Chelan, that 4 years ago I thought was pronounced Chelan. I didn't know much. This is really heavy. There, got it. I think I got it. Okay. It's 52 miles long. Do they give that wrap on the boat in the wintertime? Just the Gary doesn't do that.
I've never heard it.
Well, if you ride in the summertime, and an older fellow who drives the boat likes to give a long talk all about it. But it's 52 miles long. And it's deep. It's the second deepest freshwater lake in the country, going down to 1,500 feet.
What's the deepest? Do you know?
Crater Lake.
Oh, the deepest lake? Yeah, somebody told me today it's Crater Lake. Martha told me that. It sounds like that's consensus. I thought you said the deepest point, and that's right there. Okay. If you asked anybody in 1927 how long the lake was, they would have said, well, they would have said anything, but it was 51 miles long. In 1928, a dam was built for power down at the end in Chelan, and that raised the lake 21 feet, but also pushed it up another mile. It's Dehiken. So there are old ruins of hotels and buildings and stuff
down under the water for a mile where the lake shore is now. I just read today that, I told you, you probably all know that this was carved out by glacier action, but there's controversy over how this lake was formed. It really looks like they're two separate basins that were not connected. It looks like this is called the Lucerne Basin and the Wapato Basin, and it looks like one glacier really gouged out a deep, steep gorge here, and perhaps another one may have been pushing this way, creating a shallower and more sedimentary, not sedimentary, but there's a lot of sediment down here, a different kind of a basin, and this narrows is like a little plug that kept the two apart. And it stays plugged because there's a ridge here that keeps sliding. If you take the boat all the way up, you'll pass Slide Ridge, and it always looks like an open wound because it's always falling off into the lake or over the road. I mentioned that the deepest point was just up lake from 25 Mile Creek, and University of Washington recent soundings measured it as over 1,500 feet deep. But I've read a book this week about life on Lake Chelan in the 1890s, and there was a quote in there about soundings up to 700 feet, and they still haven't reached bottom. And I just chuckled and think, how little did they know they hadn't even gone halfway yet. The book that I mentioned is delightful, and I recommend it. Lake Chelan in the 1890s. It's a newspaper account of a boat trip up Lake Chelan with a lot of good information on the town of Lake Chelan, who was living there, who was running around in the mountains, who was prospecting where. And it was printed, maybe in a Portland paper, in 1891. Someone found this story and edited it and annotated it. Someone named Robert Byrd, who lived in Stehekin for a good long time, and he's added really good footnotes, adding more information to the history and different kinds of speculations. The man who was going up lake on the Belle of Chelan, the first steamer, noted that there was plentiful game in the region and that you could hardly go anywhere without seeing herds of up to 100 goats at a time. But he said that they soon learned to disappear over the next hill because people were always shooting at them from the steamers, from the boats, and they learned that the sound of a shotgun meant get out of here. But consequently, herds of like up to 300 were seen the next hill over. They were starting to congregate a little bit farther away. The goat was almost treated like the buffalo here, according to this one person's opinion, that it was wanton killing, and goat skins were used as cash around here. In fact, it describes that Henry Moore, who lived on Moore Point, killed 50 one winter and was selling them for $2 to $4 a skin. And so people would come in on safaris. Even somebody came in from Egypt to hunt mountain goat on Lake Chelan. Well, of course, that kind of action spurred some people to say, we need some protection. An early call in 1892 for making a national park up in this area. There's too much momentum going on with early prospecting and everybody wanting to build a railroad in every valley, and that was squelched immediately. But a seed was planted for some notion of protecting this area. Okay. Going back to Indians, there are a couple places on the lake where people have found rock paintings, which I would have assumed were very prehistoric, but there seems to be some controversy as to how old they are. But there have been some found down here by Donkey Falls and up near Stehekin off of Weaver Point. And the thing is that they're way high above the water level, even high for now with the lake being 21 feet higher. And some speculation is that maybe there was some cataclysmic event like an earthquake that dropped the lake down 30, 40 feet. Or else they had extension ladders.
What I've seen of rock paintings, they always make them real high.
Mm-hmm.
In South America, they still make them, and they always build a big platform. And I guess these beans, so that nobody disturbs them after they're done.
Huh.
Where do they go?
I didn't know that. Well, the description here was from 1891 again. Indian sign writing in red, brown, and blue paint. Figures of war parties with bows and spears of horses, wild goats, and other great animals resembling buffalo.
Mm-hmm. Well, up by Donkey Falls, there's some under the water yet.
Because they've been submerged with the lake going up?
Yeah, and they're a mountain goat.
Huh. They are a mountain goat.
What was that description again?
War parties with bows and spears, horses and wild goats and other great animals resembling buffalo. Well, if indeed they are horses, they can't be very old.
Did Werner hear this?
The ones at Donkey are up so high and they're on a sheer cliff. I mean, we tried to speculate how Indians would ever take those.
Well, that
couldn't get them from above, I don't think.
That's why there's this theory of...
they hired Ernie.
Of some kind of cataclysmic earthquakey kind of thing, because there has been a lot of earthquake activity in the area. And the man who annotates this thing has a long footnote on this. He seems to not put much stock in these Indian paintings, think that they've faded rapidly over 60 years. If they're fading that fast now, they can't be that old. He kind of poo-poos it. I don't know. I remember seeing rock paintings in northern Minnesota that weren't fading, and they were at water level, and they probably were hundreds and hundreds of years old. So,
where?
Pardon?
Where?
In northern Minnesota and Ontario.
Well, if the sun bakes in the paints, then it'll probably stay for a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they were using tempera or anything. Anybody know?
Yeah, the horses, if there are horses in the painting, someone could date an absolute limit,
right?
And that would just be a couple hundred years.
Right, the
I
horses
talk to
weren't
a lot
around
of people that don't believe that. They believe that they had horses here at the beginning of the world, you know?
Well, also this fellow, in the man from Stehekin, as he describes his paintings, he says, how they got horses and goats out of this, it's a few lines on a rock. You know, he's very skeptical that this person really saw all those creatures at all. So I can't offer any more than that. I'd like to see them. Stehekin is an Indian word, meaning the way through. The Stehekin Valley leads up to a couple of passes that are good routes for hiking types and pack horses to the west side down the Skagit Valley that will lead all the way to the coast. There are a couple of accounts, though, that the first time Stehekin was written by a white person, they're pretty sure that this person was referring to the Railroad Creek Valley over our end of the Railroad Creek into the Saddle and out through the west that way. So it's possible that the word Stehekin, meaning any old way through, we went through the mountains, and in the 1880s or whenever people started coming up here, the Indians perhaps were using this route the most often. But what was interesting to me is that they have found artifacts from even prehistoric times of those routes being used in the Agnes Valley and up in the Saddle. So there has been, again, I said, some ins and outs of people. I'm just finding dribs and drabs of things about the Indians. I wish I knew more. But apparently, sometime in the mid or late 1880s, the land east of here and to the north was made into a big reservation and went to the Canadian border and over to the Columbia. It was called the Chief Joseph Reservation. I think in the year 1880, this chunk of land from Lake Chelan over to the Methow was added to that reservation. So the Indians living along here, and there were groups of Chelan Indians, were suddenly on government land. But then, the land was suddenly open for homesteading. It wasn't the Indian sacred right anymore. And in 1886, they were given an option, the native peoples. You can move over to the reservation farther east, or you can get a plot of land here. And so, 13 families of a Chelan band, which later became known as the Wapato Indians, chose this point down here, which now bears the name Wapato. I'm sure our attitudes have changed somewhat, but I want to read the description of the land that they had chosen. Kind of interesting sidelight. Okay. "10 or 12 miles from the mouth of the lake, it boldly bends north." Those are the narrows I talked about.
and laying in the elbow thus encircled upon the north shore of the lake and extending from a point nearly opposite the Chelan to the shore of the lake after it bends northward, lies the extensive lands of the Wapato Indians, who have taken places in severalty. This is 1891. As there are 13 heads of families, and each of these has been allotted an entire section, they have managed to acquire the cream of the lands on the north of the shore, north shore of the lake. The lands they occupy of a gentle slope to the water's edge are rich and productive, admirably adapted to food growing, and well supplied with spring water. These Indians and the people of Chelan are in terms both amicable and mutually advantageous. And this is a quote by one of the ship captains, Mr. A.F. Nichols, who is incidentally from Minneapolis. Of course, we should prefer, well, this is no point of pride, of course we should prefer to see these choice lands in the possession of 200 to 300 white families, said Nichols, but we have no complaints to make against the Indians, who have complied with the laws and are peaceable and honest. Their credit to a man is A number one. I never knew one of them to break a financial obligation, and when one of them dies, his relatives or friends will pay to the last dollar his debt. They are anxious to learn the ways of the whites, live in comfortable houses, and have generally adopted the ways of civilization. Good relations. Okay. The Indians got their name Wapato in kind of a convoluted fashion. It's their Indian word for potato, which was a kind of a water lily kind of tuber that they plucked out of the water and ate. And when the Western civilization brought in our kind of potatoes, they quickly called those things Wapatos too. And so the group that lived there took on that name. They talk about Wapato Jack, who was born over in the Eniat Valley. And again, this is the description in 1972, reflecting some of that attitude that I read before. An outstanding Indian for his time and his desire to learn the white man's ways. He went to Astoria and learned about agriculture. He developed or adopted white man's ways throughout his life and came back to his homeland near the mouth of the Navar Coulee, which is near the 25 Mile Creek landing. He was one of the first Indians to farm and raise crops, including potatoes, melons, grains, and fruits in the vicinity of Lake Chelan. He raised the first apples in north central Washington from seed obtained from Fort Vancouver, which in turn was sent directly from England. And it goes on and says more, but...
That was 1972, or...?
Yeah, that was 1972. So their value was in being able to assimilate to our ways. And I don't know if there are still Native families around, either of you know?
I don't know.
Actually, I think there's a group that runs a cooperative orchard in the Manson area.
Hmm.
But I'm not sure what their connections are with the first group.
Okay. At the time this little book was written, Chelan was a town of 200 to 300 people. The first inhabitants at the town site was an army camp of some sort, I think, to come in and keep the natives down. I think that, I mean, didn't really say that, but that's sort of the feeling I got. But by 1891, there was a little town starting, and we were waiting in anticipation for the railroad to come through. And throughout the book, that was a theme that kept coming up. Everybody's waiting for the railroad to come in because then they would be able to get their goods to market and things from other markets. But as yet, that hadn't happened. The thing that I have enjoyed about reading this history is that you can become a name dropper in 5 minutes. The history is so short that so many of the settlers that were the first people here still have descendants here, or their names are used for place names. You suddenly feel like you know the whole neighborhood. One of the first men to homestead in the area was a Mr. Navar, and we've all probably driven through the Navar Coulee as a shortcut over to the highway that takes us to Wenatchee. The book said that his wife was the first white woman settler in the area. She gave birth to the first white child in the area. And they lived up the 25 Mile Creek Road part of the way in a beautiful log lodge. It was not a cabin. It sounded very luxurious, complete with a grand piano. when this book was written also, they described a colony of Italians that were living in town. Apparently they had high hopes of turning this into the Northern California for the wine growers of America and were bringing in vine stock. Well, because the book ends right there, I don't know what happened to them. Obviously, this is not another Napa Valley. It is apple, the apple capital of the world, and I don't... If anyone knows those intervening chapters, I'd be interested to find out what happened to the Italians and when the apple growers came in.
Grapes probably died and they planted apples instead.
I don't know.
Probably was daughter of Johnny Appleson.
So... A couple of them.
Tony.
A couple other colorful figures that I wanted to mention. One of them was Dan DeVore, who became the first packer and guide in the area. He homesteaded up here at Weaver Point, that's now a national park campground, but up here at the end of the lake. And some of us who have hiked in the area have hiked north out of Holden over DeVore Pass and down DeVore Creek. So he got to have a couple things named after him. He also had a dog named Whiskers, but he didn't get any creeks named after him. They just said that in the book. two other guys. This is the story I like the best. Somebody Saunders and Henry Domke were guys that were just kind of hanging out in the area. I think they tried their hand at prospecting and they didn't have much money, but they pooled their last $2.50 and bought some flour and some bacon and got an old range pony and headed for the hills, and they were going up the north side of the lake. Why this is called the north side of the lake, I've never figured out. To me it's the east, but if you're a local person, it's the north side of the lake. And they started exploring this Sawtooth area, and pretty soon poor old Prince the horse fell down a creek and took the flower with him and was never seen again. And so to this day this creek is called Prince Creek in memory of that horse. So the fellows were practically foodless and they ambled along into the next draw, decided they better do something about getting home again, and so they cut down a tree and hollowed it out and made a makeshift canoe. So what's the creek called but Canoe Creek to this day? And they made their way down Lake Chelan, and I guess this is a horrid lake to travel because winds can come up so fast. In fact, the Indians talked about a monster in Lake Chelan whipping his tail around and such. But they got down to some Indian settlement. The Indians took them in and fed them, and that's their story anyway of exploring the north side of the lake. Again and again, how rugged this country is really came alive for me, with no trails and no roads and so much brush and undergrowth.
There must have been a lot of huge sea creatures that, you know, in the lakes and things back in the early days.
Well, the Indians would certainly tell you about the sea monster. A lot of big trout. In fact, I mean, this is another thing that amazed me. Down here, there is a gorge. There's a 3-mile gorge running out of Lake Chelan. Well, not anymore because there's a dam there, but it was so steep that in 3 miles, I don't know how many hundreds of feet of elevation was lost. And then it ran into the Columbia River. Well, everybody knows that salmon come up to spawn at wherever they were born. And there used to be actual river salmon in this lake, which meant the salmon had to come up through that gorge somehow. I just thought that was amazing. I can't find out where I am on my notes here. Okay.
Libby.
Yes?
Christopher and I were camping at Lucerne last summer, and we met a fisherman, family out fishing for recreation. And the guy told us a story of a Lake Loch Ness type monster.
In the lake?
Yeah, in the lake, so that ties in with the... And also that there was a passage to the ocean, and that's how the monster got in, and that the passage got all blocked up in it.
There are still folks on the seas, and it's where...
Is that right? I'm not surprised at all.
They believe that some of these really deep lakes have a system of like underwater canals,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they swim around in the middle of the earth.
And so they come around, they come up, and then they go away. And,
I'm sure, yeah.
Like there might be just one sea monster making the round.
I go to Scotland for the summer.
In the early 1890s, prospectors were starting to come into the area, and the hot spot to go was up the Stehekin Valley, Horseshoe Basin, Park Creek, areas where people were starting to mine. Again, these were individual people or small groups of people during surface mining, but there was enough mineral up there to have people getting excited. And the Great Northern Railroad and the Northern Pacific Railroad started getting excited about this and had plans on building a railroad not only up Stehekin to bring goods up and minerals down and then down by boat, but through Cascade Pass they were going to dig a tunnel and take a railroad down to the Skagit River, which would then run west. Obviously that wasn't done, and it would have changed the whole face of the area if they would have had railroads through here. Another story that I've heard is there was a plan to build a railroad through Railroad Creek area, and that's how we got our name. Well, Warner said this morning that the way this valley got its name is that people came up here and heard the thundering creek, and it sounded like a railroad. So I can't tell you for sure how the Railroad Creek Valley got its name. But I can tell you a little bit about how Holden got its name. A young man named Holden found the first ore body. But he has an interesting history too, and there's a new book in the library on the mine that's very detailed. But it talks about how he came up here. He was on the employment of a wealthy family in Seattle named Denny, and they like to come up here for vacations to camp out for months at a time with wicker rocking chairs and everything and do a little prospecting on the side. And the women all had their starched lawn dresses and everything. Well, he decided he'd make a little reconnaissance mission up the valley and borrowed money, begged money, got enough goods to come up in the summer of 1896, I think, into this valley, and he kind of followed the retreat of the snow. He prospect the sides of the valley up and down, and it said he worked relentlessly. He knew that this was his only chance to get out of being sort of a gentleman's gentleman, was to find his own claim and to make some of his own money. According to this book by Nigel Adams on the mine, he was out hunting grouse for lunch one day in July and looked up at Copper Mountain, and there was this great ore body looking down. There are some other less romantic versions of that flying around.
What was he doing hunting grouse in July?
It said he was looking for lunch. That's what the book said. There weren't seasons then.
Laws.
No. He had enough prospecting background that he knew to go up and get some samples and had them assayed in Seattle, and they looked interesting. And he took out four claims. Again, he had to take several years off just to gather enough money and goods to come up here, but he felt that this was his hope. And while he wasn't the most expert miner, he was real good at publicity, and he would take samples everywhere. He even left a sample at the post office saying, hey, there's some ore up here, hoping to attract some people with big money who are interested. Well, apparently the economy wasn't right, and it took him a long time to slowly get going on his own. He was his own manager and incorporated, he and a few others. And I think the highest employee rate then was about a dozen men, right around the turn of the century. He never did make a huge go of it, of the mine, but knew as he started to drill in farther and farther into the mountain that there was an extensive ore body. Warner and I talked this morning about a railroad that was going to be built up this valley, and just to get the ore and take it down. It was to be an electrically powered, narrow gauge railroad. And if we go down to Lucerne now, we can still see the grade that was begun. They did extensive work on building a grade for the railroad on the Lucerne bar. They were going to have a high trestle crossing the creek from that side. They were going to start on that side and make a big, long switchback, one long switchback up the ridge and then up the valley to where the ore would have been. Obviously, that never got built. That was an expensive venture. It looked like interests were more interested in getting a smelter down in Chelan that would have been easier to build and would have taken the ore out and given them a profit. So the railroad idea was abandoned. In the meantime, some rather good ore was carried out by pack animals.
by the end of World War One, things were not going well, and the mine kind of sat. And Holden, I don't know the year of his death, but I've heard he died not a very wealthy man at all. But he had worked really hard. And there's a lot of legalese about what happened to the mine in the next couple of decades, and I don't understand that, but I do know that in the 30s, a lot of extensive exploration went on up here, not only in Copper Mountain itself, but into the upper valley, really looking to see what was around. And on the strength of that report, the Howe Sound Mining Company bought the mine in 1937 or 38, and voila, here is the town that the Howe Sound Mining Company built, and they took out the most copper of any place in the state by, I think the increase in a year of copper production in Washington was like 100-fold once Holden got into the swing of things. And Holden is really unusual in the Cascades in that there's a lot of mineral wealth to be had, but it's so hard to get to, nobody's ever been able to make a go of anything. And this, the Howe Sound Company kind of proved that wasn't always to be the case. A lot of you know a lot of history about the village. It was a model camp, and people lived well, and there was a good safety record, but the mine did close in 1958. The price of copper had dropped incredibly, and it was getting expensive to take it out. Enough on the mine, and it's getting late. Jeff, could you turn on the last pictures, and we'll just talk about our valley a little bit.
The town was originally called Chilcot.
What?
The town was originally called Chilcot.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Huh. What was that?
When was it changed to Holden?
I don't know. It was Chilean Copper. It was the name.
Chilcot? Oh, okay. Before Howe Sound bought it.
Yeah.
Chilean Copper Company.
There were some buildings with people living here.
Oh, nice. Well, the next few slides are kind of a look around the neighborhood, but this is looking down on the tailings. The big the mill was on this slope here. I'm going to take too long. It's interesting. Read about the mine, how they went in and took the ore out and the extraction process. But these tailings that are left, the ore, there weren't just like solid veins of copper ore or anything like you hear about gold mines and stuff with veins of gold. The minerals were all bound strongly to other minerals, and they had to have a chemical process to extract it. So besides crushing it, they did a chemical extraction, and all the slurry and the sludge left over went into these settling ponds that's left with the tailings. This is looking down from Martin Ridge, which is right behind us, and here's the village buildings. And another thing, Copper Creek is coming down here from Copper Basin, and that is our hydroelectric supply water. We've diverted off into our hydro plant here. Okay. Another view of the tailings now, this time from the upper mine level, looking back to Martin Ridge where the last picture's taken. Here's our road going down to Lake Chelan, the sauna, the town. Okay. This is the big mountain in the neighborhood. In fact, Bonanza is the tallest non-volcanic peak in the state, over 9,000 feet. Glacier, which is probably the closest. Here's a good picture of the hanging valley idea of glaciated valleys that met up with bigger glaciers and were just left this high valley, and Holden Lake is back in there. That's a good hike from the village, about 5 miles and a lot up. Okay? Just a little closer view of Bonanza, of course, in winter. Okay. As you look down the road, the view is of Dumbbell Peak, and that's a telephoto lens type picture. Okay. And this is a good view of Martin Ridge, which is right behind us. Here's the village down here. And if you went up to the upper mine level or to the garage level now, you'd see these just filled with the rubble of avalanches. These chutes have been carved not only by water erosion, but ice and snow erosion of avalanches that have come down over eons. Okay? How long is an eon? I'd throw that word around. Long time. Well, this is a picture of Holden Lake in the foreground, looking back toward Railroad Creek Valley, which is between the trees and this side of the mountain. This is Copper Peak, which is right above me now. The mining activity was down in here. And this is Mount Furno, which is right behind Copper Peak. And is that a glacier?
Yeah. Maybe?
Yeah.
Show people what part of Copper we see, because it's always funny to me that we don't even see near the peak from here.
I'm not sure. Do we see up to here?
Yeah.
If you go skiing up the valley, you will see a big snowfield here, and this is about all the higher you'll see. And don't you see a kind of a ridge behind it? Mm-hmm. That's part of Copper?
Mm-hmm.
Is it like a double? I don't know. Go ahead.
We gotta go off a little on my ridge.
Okay. This is the head of our Railroad Creek Valley. It's Heart Lake, the first lake straight up the valley from here, about 5 miles, and, I don't know, 700 feet above the village. This is looking up to the next lake and to the actual beginning of Railroad Creek Valley. I didn't mention, I've always been kind of interested in that. Up in this cliff, there was a molybdenum mine, the largest source of molybdenum mined in the country in 1911. Took it out by mules.
Or you mean chrome?
Nope. Molybdenum is an element. Ricky, do you know, is it used, or Christy, is it in glazes?
Molybdenum?
Molybdenum.
Molybdenum.
They use it in steel alloys, I know.
Is that steel alloys? Oh, there's all sorts of good stories about Chinese coolies and opium dens. Next picture.
Is that tunnel that you found that is right off of the trail?
No, it isn't. It's actually right in the Crown Point, because that was an exploration. This is some of the wildlife up at Heart Lake. Okay,
yes.
Next picture.
Yeah.
Wait till the next one. Okay, Jeff. Sasquatch rides again. Okay, next picture. Here's Heart Lake in the summertime. And this is the fall, as I mentioned before, Crown Point Falls draining out of Lyman Lake. And that mine was somewhere up in here. And I'm not even sure exactly where. Okay, good trout lake. Now, this is the lake above Heart Lake, Lyman Lake. And Upper Lyman Lake, and this is where I mentioned, this is where you can get into the Ice Age, because it hasn't been relatively long since this glacier retreated from here. You can see the vegetation end, and it's a wonderful study in plant succession, how little things have come in, lichens and mosses, and pretty soon trees.
Give us some idea of how recent the median years.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's like this century.
I think so. I have seen a picture from 1926 where I'm pretty sure the glacier is coming down here, at least.
Are these both trees, or are they just far away?
They're both. They're far away, and up at that elevation, there's such a short growing season and severe climate that they don't have much oomph, and all their strength is just a hanging on. If some of you have been up here, you might know or be interested to know that there was another mine up in here, just tucked away. The miner had to blast out a ledge in order to build a platform to put his mining material on, and also his little cabin. And that was precarious existence. He would take his stuff or over those mountains, this pass, Phelps Pass, and down toward Trinity. These guys were just tenuous the way they clung.
What was he mining?
That was copper. Okay. That's it.
Snow.